Serial Killing, a podcast, is researched, written, produced, and hosted by me, Alyssa Carroll. This is an independent production, no network, no contracts, and I need your support. Please subscribe, follow on my socials linked below, or go to my Patreon to show your support. Thank you so much.
Hi, listeners. I'm Vanessa Richardson, host of the podcast Serial Killers. Like many of you, I'm fascinated by the darker side of humanity. What causes someone to develop such deadly desires and why they decide to act on them? For the past 6 years, I've been able to explore these curiosities weekly, tapping into the mental states of the world's most notorious killers, examining their backgrounds and habits, searching for answers. If you haven't had a chance to check out our show, there's truly no better time to dive in. With hundreds of episodes to binge and new ones released weekly, Serial Killers is the perfect podcast for any avid true crime fan. Follow Serial Killers on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts.
From about 15 years on up, a great deal of my thoughts were basically unshareable.
We are all evil in some form or another. Yes, I am evil. Not 100%, but I am evil.
My mother was a sick, angry, hungry, and very sad woman. I hated her, but I wanted to love my mother.
This is Serial Killing, a podcast.
Hello again, and welcome to Serial Killing, a podcast, where we sometimes veer off the serial killer path to delve into other topics within our beloved true crime community. Special thanks, as always, to my patrons who voted for this episode and who get early access to each podcast. So thank you so much. You are truly appreciated. Today's podcast was voted for by patrons and will be on the very dark and disturbing history of eugenics. This is a heavy topic, and I'm truly hoping that I can make you guys proud, but anyway, let's jump right in. So, kind of how to tackle this, I really thought about it for a while, but I think I'm just going to really go through the history just sort of chronologically. So, the logical place to start is actually defining exactly what eugenics is. Dictionary.com says that eugenics is, quote, the study of or belief in the possibility of improving the qualities of the human species or a human population, especially by such means as discouraging reproduction by people presumed to have inheritable, undesirable traits. Negative eugenics is what that is, or encouraging reproduction by people presumed to have inheritable, desirable traits, which is positive eugenics, and that's end quote. The National Human Genome Research Institute defines it as, quote, the scientifically erroneous and immoral theory of racial improvement and planned breeding, which gained popularity during the early 20th century. Eugenicists worldwide believed that they could perfect human beings and eliminate so-called social ills through genetics and heredity. End quote. So in essence, eugenicists had three primary objectives. First, they sought to discover hereditary traits that contributed to social ills. Hereditary were in air quotes, in case you couldn't see me doing that. Second, they aimed to develop biological solutions to these problems. And finally, eugenicists sought to campaign for public health measures to combat them. Sources stated that the practice of eugenics began as far back as ancient Greece in some form or fashion. Greek for you, meaning good or well, and then gen for genesis or creation. Plato's works show a large interest in eugenics as a means of supplying the city-state with only the finest of offspring, chef's kiss. Plato deemed it vitally important for the future of the city, which needed to supply men for its army, which we all know was continually at war with other city-states. His writings on the subject were a blueprint for the organization of an ideal society, and with regard to eugenics, adopted the policy of ensuring, quote, judicious matings, end quote. He felt that it was literally vital to society that the correct arrangements should be made for these matings, if you will. He said that marriage for the, you know, guardian classes, which were the platinum standard of Athenian citizens, selected for their natural abilities to sort of govern the state, be abolished, and that provision be made for men and women of the same natural capacities to mate. He talked about the correlation between selective breeding of sporting dogs and horses in order to get a desired stock, so to speak. He said that the members of that guardian class should only be allowed to breed while in their prime, okay? So for men, it was after they had reached the age of 25, and for a woman, 20. Inferior members of the guardian class should be discouraged from reproducing. He said only the best of the offspring should be kept in the guardian class, and the inferior children should be relegated to the civilian classes, such as farmers or craftsmen. Plato actually wrote that the civilian classes could breed without restriction to keep the populations of the city-states constant, but take some comfort in the fact that even Plato knew that men should only have relations with women of a maritable age. A marriageable age, if you will. Incestuous unions were strictly forbidden other than brother-sister unions, which is disturbing. But, you know, you have to keep in mind that brother-sister couplings had been a common thing back then, you know, especially for the Egyptians, right? And the thought is that the Greeks just hadn't really noticed the increase in frequency of defective children resulting from two people who were very closely related. I mean, we all know the Egyptians did this to keep the throne in the family. You know. If couples are having too many children, pregnancy termination must be done before the embryo has reached the stage of, quote, sensitive life. Infanticide, or the killing of infants, should be practiced for any children born with deformities. Again, I am quoting someone else. This is not me. Aristotle entered the chat as well, but you get the gist of their thoughts and what they were aiming for. They believed human reproduction should be monitored and controlled by the state. However, Plato understood this form of government control would not be readily accepted, and he came up with a kind of lottery and under-the-radar couplings. It was a whole thing. And we can't really discuss eugenics without talking about ancient Sparta, right? We've all seen the movie, The 300. So according to thearchaeologist.org, ancient Sparta was the world leader in genetics research at that time. Their end result was to improve the genetic quality of the Spartan population. Most of us are familiar with their methods, but for those that aren't, we know that eugenics is a study of how to improve the human race through artificial selection. The most famous example is ancient Sparta, where children who deviated from the norm were thrown into the abyss, you know, allegedly. They selected and bred high-quality citizens while culling the population of lower quality individuals. And they were brutal. The man responsible for the ancient practice of eugenics in Sparta may have been a guy called Lycurgus, who was a lawgiver and military general. He rose to power in the late 8th century BC. As a ruler of Sparta, he developed a unique social system that focused on segregation and class separation. He believed that human beings were essentially different parts of animals, with some people inherently better than others due to their abilities or bloodlines. This ideology led him to implement policies such as forced marriage between members of different classes and strict birth control measures aimed at preventing poverty and inflaming racial tensions with the Spartan society. These policies have been seen as precursors to modern-day eugenics movements, which focus on improving the genetic quality or fitness of populations by reducing undesirable traits or genes. And then when the babies were born, they were examined, usually by the elders, and if they were deemed undesirable, then they were just left out to the exposure and the wild to die. The eugenics program in ancient Sparta was designed to decrease the number of women in the population. The program was based on the belief that women were weaker and less capable than men, and that they were a burden on society. This eugenics program was created in the 6th century BC by King Leonidas I to improve the population through selective breeding. It involved selecting healthy offspring from among Sparta's citizens and sterilizing or flat-out killing those who were deemed unfit for survival. The program was controversial from the beginning, and it soon came to be seen as an attack on women as well as on their reproductive rights. Indeed, it is estimated that up to half of all Spartan women may have been sterilized under this program. Another side effect was that it actually contributed to the increase of genetic disorders and diseases. This information also came from thearchaeologist.org. Other side effects of this system included an increase in violence as they were selectively breeding together for greater endurance and aggression, less fear, right? It also made discrimination much worse, and they also selectively bred dogs and other animals that ultimately made them stronger to help the Spartans in battle. So not just humans, messing with animals too. Don't take that the wrong way. And of course, there's always more, but you get the gist. So around 450 BC, the Roman Republic put out the Laws of the 12 Tables that were a consolidation of prior laws into one kind of uniform law. Table 4 is regarding the rights of familial heads, and in it, they describe the specific rights of the patriarchs of a family. One of the first things mentioned in this section relates to, quote, dreadfully deformed children that must be quickly euthanized. Babies that were born with physical or mental defects, if you will, must be murdered by their own fathers. The most common way was to drown them in the nearby river. So philosopher Seneca, while commenting on the Roman practice of eugenics, wrote, quote, we put down mad dogs. We kill the wild, untamed ox. We use the knife on sick sheep to stop their infecting the flock. We destroy abnormal offspring at birth. Children, too, if they are born weak or deformed, we drown. Yet this is not the work of anger, but of reason, to separate the sound from the worthless. End quote. Well, that's fantastic. So sources said that the Christianization after greatly diminished these ideas for around 1,400 years. I mean, it still existed, of course, but then in the early 1800s, it was Sir Francis Galton, who was a British man widely celebrated for his extensive knowledge in many areas, who really began to take a closer look at eugenics. Now, I have to preface this by saying that there is far more than this than I could fit in this podcast when it comes to this guy. It would be so many parts long, so I'm just hitting the highlights, the major players that are about this specific stuff. Okay, so Galton was allegedly the originator of the behavioral genetics movement during the British Victorian era. Oh, and interesting little fact, Sir Galton was a cousin of Charles Darwin. So he took his cousin's research and theories and applied it to humans. He observed famous and talented intellectuals, artists and athletes in relation to their families and progenitors, and concluded that mental abilities and characteristics were in fact inherited. He proposed his ideas in his writing called Hereditary Genius: An Inquiry into Its Laws and Consequences, which was published in 1869, which documents his genealogical research. Another fun fact, he also compared photographs of prisoners to determine whether facial characteristics could be correlated to particular criminal tendencies. And sidebar, I've seen some of those, or at least, you know, perusing through the internet, and they're kind of cute. So according to Harvard University, the term eugenics was actually Galton's doing, and the official word first appears in 1883 in his publication, Inquiries into Human Faculties and Its Development. He coined the term, defining it as, quote, the science of improving stock, which is by no means confined to questions of judicious mating, but which, especially in the case of man, takes cognizance of all influences that tend, in however remote a degree, to give the more suitable races or strains of blood a better chance of prevailing speedily over the less suitable than they otherwise would have had, end quote. Really, honestly, we need a title like that. That is insane. Anyway, he continued his work on eugenic concepts for the rest of his life. So in 1901, Galton delivered his speech, quote, the possible improvement of the human breed under the existing conditions of laws and sentiment, end quote, in which he summarizes the aim of a national eugenics program in both its positive and negative aspects. He said, the possibility of improving the race of a nation depends on the power of increasing the productivity of the best stock. This is far more important than that of repressing the productivity of the worst. In seeking for the improvement of the race, we aim at what is apparently possible to accomplish. To no nation is a high human breed more necessary than to our own, for we plant our stock all over the world and lay the foundation of the dispositions and capacities of future millions of the human race. End quote. And just to put it bluntly, he's like, we that are better than everyone else need to populate the earth, not the others. But he was specifically talking about Great Britain traveling and staking claim or ownership of other countries. The lecture was subsequently printed in Nature, the Reports of the Smithsonian Institution, and Popular Science Monthly. Also, according to Harvard University, quote, at the conclusion of this autobiographical account, Memories of My Life, Galton considers the goal of his work on eugenics and its contrast to Darwinian natural selection. That's a hard one to say. Man is gifted with pity and other kindly feelings. He has also the power of preventing many kinds of suffering. I conceive it to fall well within his province to replace natural selection by other processes that are more merciful and not less effective. This is precisely the aim of eugenics, its first object to check the birth rate of the unfit, instead of allowing them to come into being, though doomed in large numbers to perish prematurely. The second object is the improvement of the race by furthering the productivity of the fit by early marriages, and healthful rearing of their children. Natural selection rests upon excessive production and wholesale destruction. Eugenics on bringing no more individuals into the world that can be properly cared for, and those only of the best stock. End quote. It's just maddening. Sir Galton also came up with a method for classifying fingerprints that proved quite useful in forensic science, so at least he contributed to that. He also conducted research on the power of prayer, concluding it had no power due to its null effects on the longevity of those prayed for. But you don't want me to go there, I assure you, so we'll move on. So the Journal of the Eugenics Education Society, called, quote, The Eugenics Review, was first published in 1909. Galton, the honorary president of this society, wrote the foreword for the first volume. The first International Congress of Eugenics was then held in July of 1912. As you can see, almost through human history here. Winston Churchill himself was among the attendees for this. So according to an editorial written for Nature, quote, Galton also constructed a racial hierarchy in which white people were considered superior. He wrote that the average individual standard of the black race is some two grades below their own, the Anglo-Saxon, end quote. That's hard for me to even storytell say. But anyway, he's talking about white people there. So according to the Encyclopedia of Genocide, Galton bordered on the justification of genocide when he said, quote, "There exists a sentiment, for the most part quite unreasonable, against the gradual extinction of an inferior race." Disgusting. So then our next player is Charles Davenport. He was an American scientist and is thought of as one of history's leading eugenicists. Circling back to publications from Harvard University is one of my sources, okay? So Davenport originally got his degree in biology. He then taught at Harvard and the University of Chicago and so on, okay? That's fine. Educated man. So in 1910, the year after Galton and his Eugenics Society published, quote, the Eugenics Review over in England, Davenport and another leading mind in this new eugenics movement, a man by the name of Harry H. Laughlin, went on to establish the Eugenics Records Office in Cold Spring Harbor in New York. And then this place actually became a center for the eugenics movement and produced a whole array of research and, thusly, propaganda. In 1911, Davenport wrote the book, quote, Heredity in Relation to Eugenics, and this book wound up being used to teach students in college settings. This book was also used in high school biology education classes. Davenport believed in biological differences among races and the distinctiveness and superiority of the white race, and he passionately opposed the different races mixing. He actually advocated for racial restrictions on immigration, quote, selective elimination of undesirable people, so selective elimination meaning murder, and acceptance of the principle of the inequality of generating strains and eugenical ideas in mating, such that strains with new and better combinations of traits, strains meaning people, with new and better combinations of traits may arise and our nation take front rank in culture among the nations of ancient and modern times, end quote. So by 1920s, right, eugenics had spread to become like this whole global movement. There was popular, elite, and governmental support for eugenics suddenly in Germany, the United States, Great Britain, Italy, Mexico, Canada, and other countries. Statisticians, economists, anthropologists, sociologists, social reformers, geneticists, public health officials, and members of the general public supported eugenics through a variety of academic and popular literature. Another heavy influencer in this movement was one Ernest Haeckel. He was an important German zoologist, naturalist, eugenicist, philosopher, physician, professor, marine biologist, and artist. He discovered, described, and named thousands of new species, mapped a genealogical tree relating all life forms, and coined many terms in biology. I mean, he did a lot, a whole lot of stuff. But for the purposes of this podcast, we're just going to stick to his role in specifically eugenics. He was an advocate for scientific racism, for starters. He believed that evolutionary biology had wholly proven that the different races were unequal in both intelligence and ability, and that their lives were also of unequal value. In other words, quote, these lower races, such as the Vedas and or Australian, N-word I'm not going to say, are psychologically nearer to the mammals, apes, or dogs than to civilized Europeans. We must, therefore, assign a totally different value to their lives. End quote. As a result of the struggle for existence, he reasoned that the lower races would eventually be exterminated. And as an advocate of eugenics, Haeckel also believed that about 200,000 mentally and congenitally ill should be killed by a medical control board. This idea was later put into practice by none other than Nazi Germany, which is not a surprise to any of us, as part of the Action T4 program. That program, to sum it up as cleanly as I possibly can, that was a whole other rabbit hole. That was a campaign of mass murder, by involuntarily euthanizing people in Nazi Germany. The founder of the German Society for Racial Hygiene praised Haeckel repeatedly and actually invited him to become an honorary member, to which he, of course, accepted. Haeckel also believed that Germany should be governed by an authoritarian political system and that inequalities both within and between societies were an inevitable product of evolutionary law. Haeckel was also an extreme German nationalist who believed strongly in the superiority of German culture. And interestingly enough, one would think he was an anti-Semite, but actually, no. In the racial hierarchies, Haeckel actually assigned Jews closer to the top rather than closer to the bottom, as in Nazi racial thought. It is important to note here that in the beginning of the 20th century, so very early 1900s, the sterilization of people carrying what were considered to be hereditary defects, and in some cases, those exhibiting what was thought to be hereditary antisocial behavior, was a respectable field of medicine back then. Canada, Denmark, Switzerland, and the U.S. had passed laws enabling coerced sterilization. Studies conducted in the 1920s ranked Germany as a country that was unusually reluctant to introduce sterilization legislation. And if you can believe that, this was, you know, from before the wars. And yet, in his book, Mein Kampf, from 1924, Hitler himself wrote that one day racial hygiene, quote, will appear as a deed greater than the most victorious wars of our present bourgeois era. End quote. So the 1913 Mental Deficiency Act coming out of the UK proposed the mass segregation of the feeble-minded from the rest of society. The bill was passed with only three MPs voting against it. One of them was a man by the name of Josiah Wedgwood, who attempted to filibuster. He said the law was, quote, a spirit of the horrible eugenic society, which is setting out to breed up the working class as though they were cattle, end quote. And, you know, cheers to Josiah. Some sterilizations were carried out secretly on mental health patients by clinicians who were in favor of a more widespread eugenics plan. Again, some colleges began offering courses on the benefits of eugenics, right? So it's getting more attention. So in July of 1933, the, quote, Law for the Prevention of Hereditarily Diseased Offspring suggested forced sterilization for people with conditions thought to be hereditary, such as schizophrenia, epilepsy, Huntington's disease, and imbecility. Sterilization was also completely legalized for people who displayed chronic alcoholism and other forms of social deviance. The law was administered by the Interior Ministry under Wilhelm Frick through special hereditary health courts. The courts examined the inmates in nursing homes, asylums, prisons, what they called aged care homes, and even special schools to select these people that they wanted to sterilize. It is estimated that 360,000 people were sterilized under this law between 1933 and 1939. 6 years. 360,000 people in 6 years. But the most well-known group to take the ideas behind eugenics and run with it in the most evil and disturbing way were, of course, the Nazis, leading up to and during World War II. They thought of eugenics as more racial hygiene, if you will, and that term racial hygiene, every single source, all over the place. It just makes me uncomfortable. According to the Holocaust Encyclopedia site, German eugenics pursued its very famous and separate and terrible course after 1933 and mostly just after World War I. Germany saw economic and social devastation in the years between World War I and World War II. These factors put a larger spotlight on the growing division between people considered hereditarily valuable and those considered unproductive. An example of the site gave was that some believed that hereditarily valuable Germans had died on the battlefield during the war, like the good stock had been taken for war and died, while the unproductive Germans institutionalized in prisons and hospitals and welfare facilities remained behind, you see? And these arguments began to really resurface in the Weimar and the early Nazi days as a way to justify eugenic sterilization and a decrease in social services for the disabled and institutionalized. So by 1933, the racial hygiene movement was beginning to be in full swing, and especially with Mr. Adolf Hitler. He really preached and convinced his followers. They then all embraced an ideology that blended racial anti-Semitism with eugenic theory. In doing so, the Hitler regime was provided the factors and conditions along with the freedom for their execution of eugenic measures in their most concrete and radical forms. So people chosen for murder is what it was. Under the Nazi eugenics policies were mostly people living in private and state-operated institutions, identified as life unworthy of life. This included prisoners, degenerates, dissidents, or people who were free thinkers, you know, and people with congenital cognitive and physical disabilities, people who were considered to be feeble-minded. In fact, being diagnosed with feeble-mindedness was a one-way ticket to being forcibly sterilized and possibly euthanized. Other included people who were diagnosed by a doctor as or otherwise seemed to need sterilization or euthanasia were, here's the bullet point list: epileptic, schizophrenic, manic depressive, now known as bipolar, suffering from cerebral palsy or muscular dystrophy, deaf and or blind, homosexual or transvestites, which at the time was used to refer to intersex and transgender people, particularly trans women. And another, the last bullet point is anyone else considered to be idle, insane, and or weak. So really, if they wanted to, they could just find about any reason or excuse they needed. So more than 400,000 people were sterilized against their will, while up to 300,000 were murdered under the Action T4 euthanasia program that we talked about earlier. But as a reminder, this program was just a fancy term for the act of mass murder by forced euthanasia. Certain German physicians, right, were given the authorization to pick patients they deemed incurably sick after most critical medical examination, and then administer to them a, quote, mercy death. So from September 1939 until the end of the war in 1945, from 275,000 to 300,000 people were killed in psychiatric hospitals in Germany and Austria, occupied Poland, and a few other places. So religious groups did protest this, stating that it was wholly immoral, which of course they were right, but it did little to deter the Nazis' actions. Hitler and the Nazis considered Jews to be an inferior race of people who set out to weaken other races and take over the world. Hitler believed that Jews were particularly destructive to the German Aryan race and did not have any place in Nazi Germany. The Nazis implemented anti-Semitic laws which persecuted and oppressed Jews, like we know, and eventually led to their deportation and mass murder, as we are also very aware of. Oh, and sidebar, if anyone listening actually thinks the Holocaust didn't happen, I would love to hear, like, your thoughts and reasonings as to why you would believe that, followed up with excellent sources. I, of course, know that it did happen, but anyway, I'm still curious as to the reasons why people think that it didn't. Moving on. The Nazis' ideology rested on several key ideas, such as nationalism, racial superiority, and anti-Semitism. As their power became more secure, The Nazis quickly escalated to more direct persecution, such as the Nuremberg Laws of 1935, which stripped Jews of their citizenship in 1938. This escalation of oppression continued to intensify and radicalize until the outbreak of war, where it quickly became more lethal and eventually genocidal. In total, 6 million Jewish men, women, and children were murdered by the Nazi German regime and its allies and collaborators. And remember, that was just the extermination of so many Jews. That number does not include the around 300,000 or more of the others who were deemed undesirable, feeble-minded, who they didn't kill but actually did sterilize. So those numbers have some wiggle room. The other side of the Nazi eugenics regime is also a bit disturbing. There was an SS-initiated, state-supported, registered association in Nazi Germany known as the Lebensborn. So once the Nazis had radically purified their country, they planned on replacing the missing population with what they considered racially pure. You know, the Aryans, right? Heinrich Himmler was instrumental in what the solution would be. Aryan breeding programs. I find this part pretty disturbing as well. So they provided welfare benefits to its mostly unmarried mothers. They encouraged anonymous births by unmarried women at their maternity homes, aka Hitler's baby farms, and mediated adoption of children by likewise racially pure and healthy parents, particularly SS members and their families. The Cross of Honor of the German Mother, which is a medal, was given to the women who bore the most Aryan children. You get a medal for having the most babies. Abortion was legalized and really endorsed by the Nazis for disabled and non-Germanic children, but strictly punished otherwise, of course. It originally excluded children born from unions between common soldiers and foreign women because there was no proof of racial purity on both sides. Mm-hmm. And God forbid if you couldn't prove your racial purity, because if not, that very well could be a death sentence for you. During the war, many children were actually kidnapped from their parents and judged by Aryan criteria for their suitability to be raised in Lebensborn homes and fostered by German families, again, usually SS officers, and their wives. Many of these facilities, these birthing houses, were established in otherwise confiscated houses and former nursing homes, you know, owned by Jews, of course. Surprise, surprise. Women were also encouraged to get pregnant by Aryan-approved soldiers and give birth to those babies, all to be able to replace their otherwise racially diverse population with a country and an army of racially pure Aryan, you know, Germans. It's insanity. So according to the University of Washington, the American eugenics movement continued as late as the 1940s, so also during World War II. The American eugenics movement embraced negative eugenics with the goal of to eliminate undesirable negative eugenics, with the goal to eliminate undesirable genetic traits in the human race through selective breeding. They didn't go as far as the Nazis did in trying to exterminate an entire race. During the American eugenics movement, laws were enacted that legalized forced sterilizations and prohibited individuals that had mental or physical defects and couples of mixed race from marrying. This is stuff we already know. Now, you've heard me talk about negative eugenics, so I'd better tell you the difference between positive and negative. There are two types of eugenics. There's positive and negative. Positive eugenics had the goal of improving the human race by encouraging those with desirable traits to breed. In contrast, negative eugenics focused on reducing degenerate offspring by preventing those that had undesirable traits from breeding. I just know some kink group is going to be salivating because they keep hearing me say that word. So, positive eugenics was supported by British eugenicists, and negative eugenics was endorsed by American eugenicists. So, about negative genetics, that was based on the degeneracy theory, with the idea that unfit people are from poor environments and damaged heredity. However, American eugenicists focused mainly on the hereditary component rather than the environmental. American eugenicists believed that degenerate behaviors such as alcoholism, poverty, and social dependency were all caused by genetic defects. And there can be an argument for the genetic component for addiction and the generational trauma that can be a factor in poverty, you know, and so on. But it then expanded to people with lower IQs, abnormal behavior, sexual promiscuity, criminal behavior, and social dependency. One attempt to reduce the undesirable traits was through, can you guess? I bet you can, forced sterilization. Dr. Harry Clay Sharp and other physicians lobbied for laws to allow involuntary sterilization of those that were, quote, hereditarily defective. Consequently, the first sterilization laws were created. By the earlier 20th century, 12 states had passed sterilization laws, and 18 more eventually followed. As a result, between 1907 and 1939, more than 30,000 people were sterilized unknowingly or against their consent. Most of the sterilization operations were conducted in California, where more women were being sterilized than men, as many were deemed immoral and unfit for motherhood. Another effect to reduce the undesirable traits was through prohibition of mixed race and feeble-minded marriages. Connecticut was nearly a pioneering state. Early on, they prohibited people that were feeble-minded or had epilepsy from marrying. By 1913, 29 states prohibited mixed-race marriages as offspring with parents with two different races, again deemed as genetically inferior to those that were of a single race. The legislation continued during the 1920s and led to forced sterilizations being ruled as federally legal in 1927 through the Supreme Court case Buck versus Bell. Carrie Buck was a woman of lower economic status that claimed to have been R-worded by a rich young man. As a result, she was deemed feeble-minded and sterilized against her will. Many eugenicists accepted birth control as a method for reducing procreation of defective offspring. Leading the birth control movement, Margaret Sanger used the eugenics effort to support her agenda and went on to be the founder of Planned Parenthood. Now that rabbit hole is so disturbing, I don't even think most of you would be ready for that discussion. But regardless, Margaret Sanger was quite public about her desire to prevent breeding of the unfit, just as other eugenicists, and Margaret was most certainly a eugenicist. She also supported sterilization of those mentally unfit. Sanger stated that birth control is a way to prevent the defectives from producing offspring. A direct quote of hers, quote, "Birth control itself, often denounced as a violation of natural law, is nothing more or less than the facilitation of the process of weeding out the unfit, of preventing the birth of defectives, or of those who will become defective." End quote. So there you go. And another fun fact, in his book Mein Kampf, Hitler referred to American eugenics and cited how successful the sterilization laws were in California. Mr. Hitler had a comment. So Oregon was the last state in the United States to repeal its forced sterilization laws in 1983, folks. 2,648 people had been forcibly sterilized in that state by then. And let's not sit here and pretend that eugenics is still not being used in some form or fashion even today. I don't want to get into the current political climate. We don't argue about that shit here. But it is still happening. And according to genome.gov, there are some concerns with how the new and fastly growing business of the DNA sequencing and genome sequencing that we are able to do now will wind up turning some genome editing, you know, for genetic enhancements that would fall under positive eugenics, by the way. So this is a fascinating topic. It's fascinating to me. It's a wholly sad one for human history, but again, it is still being practiced in some form or fashion today. We have been selectively breeding as a species for the whole of human history, one way or another. So basically, eugenics can go either way, right? So if I were being completely honest and transparent with you guys, I'd say eugenics is about 99% evil and 1% common sense. People with severe cognitive issues or are otherwise having to be housed and cared for in facilities are not able to support themselves financially, emotionally, like very, you know, severely affected people. They're cared for in facilities, mental health facilities, who will never be able to be out on their own and care for themselves. Well, I guess it's not really that I think it should happen, but I do question, does it happen in these facilities? Do they give the women birth control if it's facilities that men are also at? How do I ask this question delicately so to not be offensive? I'm just not trying to be offensive, but I am curious. So if you know anything about that, drop a comment and let us all know. Educate us. But yeah, anything past that's kind of a slippery slope, guys. So what do you think about this? This one was kind of a hard one to research because, as funny as it is, I can sit and look at crime scene photos and read about just the most horrible stuff. You guys know, you know. But when it comes to like the Holocaust, genocides, and all of these, oh, it just, it's hard. It is hard. But anyway, I hope you enjoyed this. Thank you again for listening. Because I know you could be listening to anyone else, but you chose me, and I really appreciate that. Thank you so much, guys. Have a good day.
Anybody who killed more than two or three people was a mass murderer, and whether it was all at one place or over an extended period of time, and then in the early 80s, they came up with this differentiation called serial killing.